I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Scientists are learning more about how the brain constantly renews itself. Technological interventions offer the promise of not only addressing the problems of those with mental illness, but also teaching all of us effective ways to make our brains more fit. Today, we'll talk to several doctors participating in a national Brain Futures 2015 conference in Annapolis next month. What will it take to put new tools in the hands of clinicians? Some of the new apps and software are being marketed directly to consumers. How can we make smart decisions about which new technologies we can trust? Those questions and yours on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us. The Mental Health Association of Maryland is marking its 100th birthday. It's an advocacy nonprofit. It's known for organizing mental health first aid courses and for lobbying the legislature for regulations and publicly funded treatment for people with mental illness. But it chose to celebrate its centennial by putting together a national conference that looks ahead at research and cutting-edge technologies aimed not just at intervening in mental illness, but also at brain fitness. What's new in what we understand about how the brain works, and what needs to be done to put new tools in the hands of professionals and consumers? The conference will take place in Annapolis in about 2 weeks. It's called Brain Futures 2015. We'll put a link to it on our website. Full disclosure, I serve on the board of the Mental Health Association of Maryland. I am no expert in mental health, but several of my colleagues on the board are, and one of them, Henry Harbin, is here to give us an overview of some of the pressing issues in mental health. Dr. Harbin is a psychiatrist with more than 4 decades' experience in behavioral health. He's past director of Maryland State Mental Health Authority, and he's chaired 2 national behavioral health companies. Henry Harbin, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
And with us by phone from Frederick is psychiatrist Dr. Michael Knabel. He's executive director of the Sylvan C. Herman Foundation and medical director of a residential facility in Frederick for adults with severe mental illness. He has written more than 70 publications on neuropsychiatric disease, and he'll be speaking at the Brain Futures Conference. Dr. Knabel, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me.
just barely good afternoon, and I'm glad you could join us. Dr. Harbin, you told me something last week that really caught my attention. You said the suicide rate in the United States has not budged in 20 years. The CDC says it's about 13 deaths a year per 100,000 residents. Can I infer from that that mental health care is not keeping up with the advances we see in other kinds of medicine?
Well, it's a good question. Yeah, the suicide rate last year, I think, was about 40,000 successful suicides, and that rate has stayed pretty much the same for years. While there have been some refinements in the treatments for mental health and substance abuse problems over the last 2 or 3 decades, meaning that some of the psychosocial interventions have been refined, some of the uses of medications, but we haven't, for instance, in the medication, the psychiatric medication issue, there's been no new novel treatment compound for almost 3 decades. We have a lot of different psychiatric medications. Some of them are used because they have different types of side effects. But in the overall efficacy of them, or a new type of brain impact, there hasn't been much change for quite a while. There are some in the research arena. There's been a big expansion in resources to treat mental health and substance abuse over the last 10 to 20 years, partly due to the mental health federal parity law, which requires an equalization of coverage for mental health and substance abuse as compared to medical and surgical treatments. And the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, also expanded coverage. But despite that coverage, we haven't seen the kind of impact on the ultimate outcomes, which is the death rate.
Well, does that mean that the science that would be behind new interventions isn't there, that we don't have scientific breakthroughs in mental health and how the brain works?
Yes, I would say we are lagging behind other organs of the body, heart and lungs, et cetera. There's been a tremendous expansion of research in the brain, really, for 2 or 3 decades. If you remember the decade of the brain was in the 1990s. And it's been slow, the progress of identifying the exact how the brain works and some of the causes. So while there's been progress, these have not translated very rapidly into new treatments. And one of the purposes of this Brain Futures Conference is that it is going to highlight some of these emerging treatments, some of which are already being used in clinical practice, but not everybody knows about them. And one of the goals of this conference is to try to help spotlight what could be done to accelerate the translation of these innovative treatments into clinical practice so they're available to more families and patients.
Dr. Knebel, let me pull you into this conversation because you, in addition to your work as a medical director, as a clinician, sort of hands-on helping people who are struggling with mental illness, you also have a history of, I understand you were executive director of the Stanley Foundation, which has made huge investments in research on mental health. What is your view of the situation? Are we do we not have the science we need to make advancements in how we address mental health, or are we just slow to put them in place?
Well, I agree with Dr. Harbin for the most part. There's been a tremendous explosion in brain research, although most of it has been geared towards kind of basic neuroscience about how the brain works, all of which is necessary and important and needs to continue. But I think one thing that's been neglected is research regarding how the mental health system actually gets to patients and how the different parts of the mental health system work together to create incentives for all the different parts of the so-called mental health system to keep patients stable, functioning well, and out of the hospital. So I think, I'm very much in support of brain research and trying to figure out how to translate the discoveries more rapidly. But I also think that our mental health policy has lagged behind in developing ways for the mental health system to serve people better. It's broken up into lots of different pieces, hospital, partial hospital, private practices, residential. And really there's no financial incentive or practical incentive for these different groups to really cooperate and maintain stability of patients with very severe forms of these illnesses. And I think that's one of the reasons we find so many of our patients in jail or homeless.
As I listen to you, though, I'm trying to figure out who should be, on whose shoulders is the responsibility for that kind of unifying policy. Is that something that government should have supplied and didn't? Where does it come
from? So the National Institute of Mental Health is the federal agency that's responsible for figuring out how the brain works and how that might apply to developing new treatments. There is a large federal agency called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is a gigantic organization with $3.7 billion annual budget. And they're supposed to be in charge of services research. And so they're the main body. In addition to them, there are probably 90 to 100 different federal agencies that have something to do with mental health.
90 to 100?
Yeah, so there are departments in the Veterans Administration, in the Department of Defense, the National Institute of Drug Abuse. There are lots and lots of different agencies, and there are, before Congress now, at least two bills that seek to improve the coordination amongst these different agencies, to hold them accountable, to get them talking to each other, to reduce redundancy, and to focus more on service delivery and getting people better treatment. And in my own view, SAMHSA, I think, has drifted away from the core mission of caring for people with the most severe forms of these illnesses.
Refresh my memory again. SAMHSA is the drug
abuse. Substance Abuse and Substance Mental Health abuse. Services uh-huh. Administration. Probably the largest federal agency that's supposed to be focused on how do we deliver services to people? How much should be in state hospitals? How much should be in public clinics? How do we organize the private sector? And in my own view, I feel SAMHSA has drifted away from many of those questions.
So, yeah, Henry.
I would agree with Dr. Knebel in part, but the fragmentation and kind of confusion of services in mental health and substance abuse are similar to on the medical side. So, you know, part of the Affordable Care Act was to try to, you know, create some incentives that the different parts of the medical system would work together. And I agree that there are some changes that could be made in terms of how people are cared for in these different fragmented pockets of delivery for mental health people and people with addictions problems. But that doesn't really still address getting into their hands new treatments. If you had a more better functioning system, they might use these new treatments better. But there's been a real lag time in what some of that this conference will focus on, new ways to treat some of these serious mental illnesses or moderate mental illnesses and addictions problems, that we need to focus on. How do we accelerate getting these techniques out there quicker?
Why is there a lag time? Such a lag time.
Yeah. Well, there's a lag time in all medical treatments. I may have shared this with you earlier. There's almost a 15-year lag time between any medical treatment, medical or surgical treatment, by the time it's kind of proofed out as okay for patients by whatever process, FDA or otherwise, before it's widely disseminated. It's usually a few years longer in the mental health and substance abuse field. I think one of those is we don't have as many innovative new treatments that have come out of the research lab, as both Dr. Knebel and I were referring to earlier.
Don't have as many in the mental
health. Yeah, we don't have as many in the mental health area, but the ones that we do sometimes have a long lag time. So, for instance, one of the new treatments is a treatment called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a non-invasive way to treat depression and other mental health disorders. So it's basically you guide some magnetic waves externally into the brain to stimulate different circuits to address different symptom problems. And even though that technique was approved by the FDA several years ago, it's been had multiple randomized research trials. We still don't have most of the insurance companies paying for it. And in some cases, some of the clinicians or physicians that could use this are not aware of it, and they don't adopt it or they don't invest in that kind of treatment. So it's a mixture of clinicians not being aware of and being willing to try something new, and also a reimbursement problem.
That's Dr. Henry Harbin, a psychiatrist, a member of the board of the Mental Health Association of Maryland, and one of the brains behind the Brain Futures Conference that's going to be held in Annapolis in a little over 2 weeks that we're talking about today. Also with us on the phone from Frederick is psychiatrist Michael Knebel, who's executive director of the Sylvan C. Herman Foundation. And I'm a little surprised, actually, that this conversation has taken a turn toward talking about these big pauses or the slow pace of the overall sharing of information. Because the particular reason, Dr. Knebel, that I wanted you to be part of this conversation is you're going to be talking at the Brain Futures Conference about a nonprofit that you started called Cyber Guide. Let me spell it so people get the full impact of it. It's PSYBERGUIDE, Cyber Guide, which is very much focused on consumers and their access to new ideas and interventions in mental health. Tell us about that.
Yes, so I was approached by a foundation in New York called the Bowman Family Foundation and also the Herman Foundation to set up a website that sought to become an unbiased sort of consumer reports resource on new technologies in mental health, specifically treatments that are delivered by software and mobile phone apps.
Give me an example. I confess I'm not really aware. What would be an example of an app or software that, as someone with a mental health issue or just worried about how my brain is functioning, that I might turn to?
Right. Well, let me preface that by saying that, you know, the field of medical software apps is exploding. There are probably more than 40,000 apps related to medical conditions that you can get on the App Store. Probably about 3,000 to 4,000 of those claim to have something to do with mental health. And the interesting thing about these is that they evolve very rapidly. they're not regulated by any government agency, and they're usually not tested in clinical trials. So patients would frequently come to me and ask just what you've asked, which one should I pick? And we really had no way of comparing them one to another to check on their quality or their safety. So we decided to try to make a clearinghouse that would have lots of information in lieu of clinical trials on these particular apps. So most of the apps that are out there now are so-called symptom trackers, which are designed to allow the patient to keep track of mood or the regularity of their sleep or the regularity of taking medications, and then share that information with their psychiatrist or psychologist. But increasingly, there are apps that propose to actually deliver treatments to people, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a tried and true method. It's very evidence-based. It's been shown over and over again that it works quite well for various forms of depression and anxiety. And there are quite a lot of software, computer software and mobile apps that propose to deliver this treatment. And one that I just reviewed recently is called MoodKit, and it got a very high rating on in our rating system, and it costs $4.99. And it's quite attractive. It has many of the principal components of classical CBT, as well as a lot of kind of novel additions, and I think would be quite attractive for many people to use.
So is it you doing all these reviews, or do you have a whole team of people who look into these apps and see what they're based on and whether they're reliable and whether they're a good bet for a consumer to buy?
We have an internal team of three people, one of whom is me, and we have a web designer and a psychologist who helps with sort of the acquisition of data about these apps. Then we hire outside reviewers who tend to be academics to help us write more detailed reviews of the apps. So we have our own internal review and rating scale. We hire experts to provide detailed expert reviews. And we recently created a portal for consumers themselves to go on and say what they think about apps. And eventually, we hope to aggregate all these different kinds of data to be able to come up with a single number for each app that rates them and ranks them so people can easily go on and make a choice.
We're going to take a break here, and we're going to talk more about CyberGuide and some other things when we get back. We're going to continue our conversation about what's new in brain health. And if you would like to be part of the conversation, please call us, 410-662-8780. Long distance, you can call 866-661-9309. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'd like you to be part of this conversation. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to be back with Dr. Henry Harbin on the board of the Mental Health Association of Maryland and Dr. Michael Knabel. And we'll also speak to a behavioral neurologist who says mental health professionals should have better tools to find the right medicines for their patients. Stay with us on 88.1. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the frontiers of mental fitness, some of the issues that will be addressed at the Brain Futures Conference in Annapolis next month, organized by the Mental Health Association of Maryland to mark its centennial. In the studio with me is Dr. Henry Harbin, a psychiatrist who has headed several big behavioral health enterprises. And with us by phone from Frederick is psychiatrist Michael Knabel, medical director of Clearview Communities and founder of the nonprofit we were talking about, CyberGuide, PSYBERGUIDE, which gives consumers background to sort out new apps and software technologies. And I want to talk more about that, but I want to bring somebody else into the conversation. One of the biggest frustrations that I hear from people coping with mental illness is that once they have decided to get help, even after they've been diagnosed with a particular ailment, it can be months or years of trial and error trying to find the right medications. And some of us who don't know that much about mental illness think that's how it has to be. But I gather, Henry Harbin, that the Brain Futures Conference is going to take that issue up.
Yes, one of our topics will be, and Dr. Lombard is one of the speakers, is on personalized medicine or identifying markers in the brain and elsewhere that could tell you which psychiatric drug is likely to work. There's a lot of research going on there, but only a few companies actually have a product on the market that patients and clinicians can use. And so we're going to have at the conference three of those companies presenting, one that measures genes, which Dr. Lombard will talk about.
Well, I haven't introduced Dr. Lombard yet, so let me pull him into the conversation. Jay Lombard is a behavioral neurologist. He's co-founder, medical director, and chief scientific officer of a company called Genomind. It's based in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, but we're catching him in New York today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I'm going to ask you in a second to give us a brief description of what Genomind does, but I want to ask you first how you came to focus on this area.
Well, as a neurologist, very frequently there's an interface of both, issues that are biological and psychological. In fact, I think every condition that all physicians face are a combination of both biological and psychological features. I think Patrick Kennedy once said it best that there is no health without mental health. And people would ask questions about, how do you know that if my child has autism, for instance, isn't it just your opinion? What's the right medication? How do you know it's the right medication? And I realized that we have tools at our disposal, and this is something called translational neuroscience that you talked about earlier in the show, that help us to understand not only the biological basis of common psychiatric disorders, but also helping us to reframe our understanding about these conditions so that we can choose better medications. And by the way, not only medications. I think there are many, many non-pharmaceutical approaches to psychiatric disorders that should be discussed as well. So I think the more we understand about the biology of mental health or the neurology of mental health, the better we will be at treating our patients.
So tell me what Genomind does. What does your company do? How do you I gather this is a form of personalized medicine. How do you make the personalized?
Well, first of all, I think that there's this notion that there's a sort of a cookie cutter way that we unfortunately approach patients with psychiatric disorders, that we give them a diagnosis and then we think categorically about medications that are approved for that diagnosis. And then we don't take into account the significant heterogeneity of psychiatric disorders. Autism is not a single disorder. Depression, bipolar, these are not single conditions. They are very complex. They're very heterogeneous. So what Genomind does is actually it's a tool. It certainly does not or is not meant to replace a very good clinical history and asking the provider to do a detailed history for their patients. But it gives an extra boost, if you will, to the dialogue. Because now a treating physician has at his disposal some of the biological factors that are relevant both to how a medication is disposed of in the body, but also how those different medications target different areas of the brain, which we know are biologically based.
Well, you've gotten ahead of me, though. I mean, what does Genomind actually do so that a clinician has that insight, has that knowledge about me if I present as a patient?
It's actually a very simple process. We collect a small amount of saliva. We do a DNA analysis of some of the more relevant genes. We know there's a lot of genes involved in all biology, including psychiatric disorders, but there are only a certain number of genes that we know have been associated with treatment response. So we test a small number of genes so that we're able to have a dialogue with treating physicians to educate them on the importance of these biological factors and help them to arrive at better medication choice. It's a very simple process where a person would go to their physician, especially if they've had failed previous medication trials, and we actually analyze these genes, give a report out, and with that, the patient or the doctor directly helps to inform the patient on treatment decisions that would be different than if they did not have this information.
How long does it take? How much does it cost?
It's the whole turnaround is about 3 days, sometimes 4 days. It's very, you know, we understand that, you know, people suffering from mental disease don't want to wait months for results. So it's a very quick turnaround period. In terms of cost, right now, we are talking to many insurance companies to demonstrate to them that this is a cost-saving issue for them because, you know, not treating mental health properly is very expensive, not only on the psychiatric or the existential aspects of disease. It's also very expensive medically because a high overlap of individuals who suffer from mental disorders with physical disease. And there is a very high relapse rate that is very expensive to treat. So our point of view is that we'd like to see insurances accept this. We've made it very cost effective so that it's not a sort of an impossible argument to make so that they can actually reimburse this for patients.
Let me remind our listeners that if you've got some thoughts about what kind of information ought to be in the hands of clinicians, in the hands of consumers to address mental health and brain fitness, call us, 410-662-8780. Are you a doctor who's recommended apps for your patients? Do you use apps or websites designed for mental health treatment? 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Dr. Henry Harbin, Jay Lombard is not the only one who's going to be presenting something in this area at the Brain Futures Conference.
Correct. In the conference, we're actually going to have three companies presenting. GenoMind is one of them on how they measure these biomarkers or these predictors of how psychotropic drugs best work. And we have one called CNS Response that is EEG. Uses EEG or brain imaging to help guide what drug to pick. And then we have another company called Brain Resource that uses a mix of genetics test, EEG testing, and cognitive testing, like a psychological test, that combined helps you guide what psychiatric drug to pick. And I think Dr. Lombard's put it well. As you've said earlier, Sheila, there's a trial and error process that can sometimes take a long time because we don't a psychiatrist or a neurologist doesn't know ahead of time whether a particular drug will work for that person. So even if it's an approved antidepressant like a Prozac or Paxil, you may have to go through five different drug trials before you find the one that matches that person's individual brain physiology, etc. So these are early stage companies that have a clinical tool out on the market that people can begin to use. And there's a lot of research, again, as we talked earlier about the neuroscience has a lot of research, but so much of that has not translated yet into something that would be useful to a patient today.
Jay Lombard, what can you it's not quite clear to me what you can discover from genes that will predict whether somebody will experience side effects from a medication.
Okay. So I'll try to break it down. So most psychiatric drugs are metabolized by the liver, and there are certain enzymes that we inherit from our families that control the rate of breakdown of these medications. And the variability in how these drugs are metabolized frequently is a significant cause of adverse drug effects. So if you have very slow metabolism of certain enzymes that are due to genetic impairments in those enzymes, a person may have higher blood levels. And not knowing that, a psychiatrist or a treating physician would give the same dose of a medication to a person and yet have much higher levels of the drug and therefore have higher adverse drug effects. So that's a frequent reason why people are non-compliant with psychiatric medication. It makes them feel worse, not better. They have side effects that really are problematic, and they're told to, you know, grit their teeth and work through it, when in fact, knowing that they're more prone to these side effects would allow the doctor to switch medication.
To our listeners, if you've had this experience of the trial and error search for the right treatment, the right medication, I'd love to talk to you about it. You can call us at 410-662-8780. 8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'd like you to be part of this conversation. We're talking with Jay Lombard, a behavioral neurologist and the co-founder of a company called Genomind, which does a quick turnaround genetic test to figure out what medications might work best for an individual. With me here in the studio is Henry Harbin from the board of the Mental Health Association of Maryland, a psychiatrist who has headed several large behavioral health organizations. And on the phone with us from Frederick, Maryland, is psychologist Michael Knabel. We were talking to him about a nonprofit he started in addition to his work as a clinician and other work he does, a nonprofit called Cyber Guide, to help consumers sort out what kinds of apps and software could actually be the right choice for them if to use to address a mental health issue. Dr. Knabel, when people turn to you for that kind of advice, have they basically, Jay Lombard just mentioned people becoming non-compliant with medications, which to me, as a layman says, they sort of drop out of professional medical help and say, I'm going to solve this on my own. Is that what people are doing when they turn to CyberGuide for advice about what kind of app or software could help them?
No, I don't see it that way. I think that many of these apps and softwares can really empower people to take control, more control over managing their illness, but really not a substitute for, you know, working with a professional. In most instances, I think, you know, perhaps there are some milder conditions in which, you know, they could be self-managed. But, you know, the population I treat that tends to have more severe forms of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or recurrent depression, the technologies enable the patient to sort of engage the illness on a daily basis, collect data, or work on the illness therapeutically, and then share the information with their psychiatrist or psychologist. So as of now, these things are not substitutes for going to clinicians and, you know, having careful monitoring of the illness.
I can well imagine that you as a professional with, you know, deeper understanding than most of us have would see it's not a replacement. I'm curious, though, and maybe you just don't get that kind of feedback from the people who use CyberGuide. I mean, I'm wondering whether people who have been through a trial or in the midst of a trial and error process, for example, in finding a medication, do see it as a substitute. Do you have any feel for that?
I think those are two slightly different things. I mean, the Genomind test and similar products have been very helpful to us when we see patients who've not responded to medications or had a lot of side effects. But the technological apps, the apps and software, have been very helpful in getting a better picture of what happens to people on a daily basis, or being able to give them something to work on therapeutically when they're not in session, so that they're, I mean, these are chronic illnesses that people have to face on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going once a month to a psychiatrist or once a week to a psychologist, for the more severe forms of illness, it's not enough. And most people don't have access to very comprehensive, detailed daily care that you need to recover, especially in the early phases of these you know, more severe illnesses. So we're thinking, how can we use technology to connect with the patient, to engage the patient, to get them to really work on these things, and hopefully increase their independence and ability to function in the world over time. They're sort of extenders of what traditional professionals would do.
Henry Harbin.
Yes, I agree with Dr. Knabel. I think for more severe mental health or substance abuse problems, these technology add-ons or additions or expanders would be used as an enhancement or a good companion in professional treatment. But when you look at the whole range of people that suffer from depression and anxiety and mild to moderate alcoholism and drug problems, many of them won't go to therapy at all, and some of them don't need to be on medication. So, for instance, the average number of visits, if you look at all the people that visit a mental health professional, who's, the average number of visits they go for are 3 when you look at the data nationally. So it tells you that a lot of people are just dropping out. They may be dropping out because the drug didn't work, or they may be dropping out because they don't want to go to therapy, they don't understand their problem. So many of these gaming and these apps and the things that CyberGuide is doing a great job in providing guidance about which ones work can sometimes be a substitute for someone who's not going to go to treatment at all and could be helpful. I don't think they're a replacement. I agree with Dr. Knable. But for many people, they can be very effective. In fact, there are several studies now showing at least for mild depression and anxiety disorders, some of these cognitive behavioral therapies that are basically a computer interaction between the patient and the computer can be as effective as face-to-face therapy. So when you'll hear in this conference, we have several really leading experts on these computer games. One is a Dr. Ghazali from University of San Francisco, University of California, San Francisco, has been a leading developer in this area. He's developed a computer-based game that helps treat attention deficit disorder. And he's now combining that with virtual reality, EEG biofeedback, and the computer game to try to figure out how to help people improve those symptoms of attention deficit problems. Again, that's not a replacement necessarily, but as an adjunct to whatever other treatment they're getting. We also have one of the leading developers of video games to help people with symptoms of mental illness named Jane.
I'm sorry, video games that help people with symptoms of?
With symptoms of attention or anxiety or cognitive improvement. And these are sometimes called serious games, meaning they're using video games to improve a mental health or brain condition. And Jane McGonigal is her name. She's one of the leaders in this. She's the director of game research and development for the Institute for the Future. We then have several other speakers who are going to talk about the use of computer games to enhance brain functioning, even for people who don't have a mental illness but want to boost their brain fitness.
Huh. I would love to hear from any of our listeners who have used a computer game for that purpose or who are even thinking about using a computer game. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be back in a couple minutes with psychiatrist Henry Harbin and Michael Knable and behavioral neurologist Jay Lombard. And with your calls, 410-662-8780. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about mental illness, mental health, and brain fitness. In a little more than 2 weeks, scientists, researchers, clinicians, and consumers and their families will gather in Annapolis for a conference called Brain Futures 2015. It's about the latest research and also how technology could change things for people with mental illness and for people just interested in having a healthier brain. I'm here with psychiatrist Henry Harbin in studio and psychiatrist Michael Knable in Frederick. He is the founder of a nonprofit clearinghouse on apps and software that people can use for mental both to address mental illness and mental fitness. It's called CyberGuide. And on with us from New York City is Jay Lombard, the co-founder of the company GenoMind, which does a genocept assay, that is to say a genetic test, to help clinicians figure out what kind of medication and other treatments might work best for different people. More than 2,500 clinicians and over 50,000 patients have used the genocept assay. We've got some callers on the line. Margie from Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you. My question is, would the GenoMind test work for seizure medicines too? That seems to have side effects that are very difficult for patients.
Let me ask Dr. Lombard. Margie wants to know whether the kind of genetic testing that you're doing would help people figure out the right kind of seizure medication?
That's a great question. And certain psychiatric drugs are metabolized by the same liver enzymes as psychiatric drugs are. So to a certain extent, the data would be relevant for conditions like seizures as well. Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Margie. Sue in Edgewater has kind of a parallel question, I think. Welcome to Midday, Sue.
Thank you. I was wondering if the doctors know of any new treatments or medications that would help autistic adults and some of their behaviors be able to work to get jobs in the community so their behaviors are not so impactful on others.
Sue, let me ask. I'm going to throw that at you, Henry Harbin, whether anything in this conference will address autism in adults.
Yes, there will be some of the speakers. I don't know that any of them are talking about particular psychiatric medications for autism or medications in general, but there are several who are going to, one is going to be talking about the use of magnetic stimulation for autistic people, both adults and children. There are some others that are, I think, talking about some of the games or the computer interventions that might enhance functioning with people with autism. So I would say there are a couple of speakers and topics that will focus on that to some degree.
Thank you for the call, Sue. And Kathleen in Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm really glad you're talking about this. I was a little depressed, and within 4 months, the psychiatrist had me on high doses of 4 different antidepressants. I pretty much lost my mind for 9 years, and I lost my prescription, and my brain clicked on the third day. Since then, I've been, it's been 9 years, I've been putting my life back together again, and last year, I had my brain scanned at the Amen Clinic along with spit tests, and they recommended phytonutrients and meditation and exercise, and I feel like I've come back to life. It's taken 9 years, and I just wish that they would look at people, scan their brain first, try and figure it out, because what I had was post-traumatic stress disorder.
So you were misdiagnosed?
Yes, and I... But it put me on, I mean, all of these side effects became like full-blown problems. I couldn't leave my house. I couldn't remember my best friend's names. I couldn't have relationships. I couldn't work. I couldn't feed myself. I had a really hard time bathing. And then when I lost the medication, I had to relearn how to do that and to have a job, of which I've been employed for 9 years. But with the brain scan last year and having the phytonutrients, spirulina and lecithin and different things, I finally have drive. I have a sense of grounding, and I wish that they would, you know, try that route first before they add, you know, give you medication.
Dr. Lombard, let me ask you to comment on Kathleen's experience. She's talking about brain scan, which I realize is not the same as genomic testing, but I'm curious as to what your reaction is to her story.
A few points. One is that, unfortunately, that is very often the norm, not the exception, to have people, you know, have multiple treatments and then more medications layered upon them to treat side effects. The second point is about brain imaging, and I think that there is a great deal of enthusiasm and excitement for this technology, but the particular technology that the call is referring to probably is not the right type of imaging technology that people should be thinking about. It's called SPECT scanning, but there are new advances in brain imaging technology that are very, very important. They've not reached the clinic yet that can help identify the biological basis for psychiatric disease. And the third point, I think, is also an important point, though, which is there are many non-pharmaceutical agents or interventions that are of benefit for patients with mental health disease. The problem is that there's just a lack of data on these compounds, and we need to do a very careful analysis of what's evidence-based and what's not. So, for instance, there's some very strong data that omega-3 fish oil can be helpful for certain patients with bipolar depression. Methylfolate, which is another vitamin that appears to have a great benefit in certain patients with depression, especially those that have genetic impairments in the metabolism of folic acid. So I think there's a lot of good points that the listener just raised. But, of course, the devil's in the details.
Henry.
Yes, a couple of points. We actually have a speaker from the National Institutes of Health who is the acting chief of the section on nutritional neurosciences. So one of the issues that the caller brought up was on the use of non-prescribed drugs, nutritional. So we're going to get an update on the effect on some of the research on different nutritional elements for brain health. I think the other point is that many people are given medications, even if they're not working, partly because they don't know which one's going to work ahead of time without one of these marker tests. And they don't try things like exercise, nutrition, and other things that would be also helpful to getting a person out of their depression.
Yep.
Kathleen, I appreciate your calling us. I want to move to Storm in Waverly, who is calling with a different point.
Hi. I just had a question and a little bit of a comment, too. I just want to harken back, especially to the beginning of the show when you guys were talking about how mental health is really lagging behind a lot of the other fields in medicine right now. I was wondering if you thought that was related especially to the social stigma around having mental health disorders and around mental health treatment. And I was then also wondering with this conversation about the video games, if you think that that is going to help contribute to, like, lessening that social stigma, especially among teens where there's a much higher suicide rate, a much higher suicide rate among LGBT teens. Because I do know, like, personally, as a younger person with mental health disabilities, it's difficult for me, especially to try and lead an adult working life with this, so, you know, very strong social stigma that's out there.
Storm, thank you for the call. I want to ask Dr. Knabel and Frederick his reaction to that question.
Yeah, several points. I think first, you know, we're not lagging behind because of a lack of effort. I think underlying most of this is the difficulty of studying the brain and the brain's accessibility to, you know, understanding it. It's different from the heart and the kidney and the liver, and then it's been traditionally very difficult to study its inner workings. I think that's the main issue, although I do agree that stigma has been an issue also for our field. But there are, you know, many publications coming out recently that say that stigma is not the main thing that keeps people from getting treatment. It's more related to cost, accessibility of treatment. I think we've done a pretty good job on reducing the burden of stigma, although it still exists. But access to care is a major issue for many people in many parts of the country. And we're hoping that technology and apps and software can bridge some of those gaps. And I think the caller is right that there's a tremendous destigmatizing effect of these apps. People feel like they're getting more control over their treatment, more control. They're self-monitoring better. They're learning more about the illnesses and how to manage them. And this is especially true for young people who are just instantly attracted to these applications and want to engage with them and seem to improve.
Dr. Knabel, let me just give Henry Harbin one quick last word.
I'll say one thing that around this issue of stigma is that Patrick Kennedy is, the Kennedy Forum, which is an advocacy group, is a sponsor of this, and Patrick Kennedy would be speaking, and he's doing a lot to make stigma less important. He just published a book on this family struggles. He'll be a speaker, and we'll be talking about his book there.
I thank you all. Henry Harbin, former State Director of Mental Health, psychiatrist Michael Knabel, the founder of CyberGuide, and Jay Lombard, co-founder and medical director of GenomeMind. Tune in tomorrow. We'll be talking about breast cancer, treatment, research, and prevention. And up next at the top of the hour, Here and Now. Thank you for being part of this program. I'm Sheila Cass. This is Midday. Come back tomorrow.